which makes all kinds of maths in our parallel universes possible and immediate. She was 23 when the wall fell, part of the fortunate younger generation which could catch up with its Western contemporaries. She could get an education and a new life, instead, like many older people, of just losing her old one. But Julia is still studying some, by her own admission, obscure Eastern Bloc languages at Humboldt University, languages which can only be of use if she goes to hide out in the obscure places in which they are spoken. Students in Germany often stay at the university into their late 20s, but it seems to me that she is never going to leave. I'm curious about her. A single woman in a single room at the top of her block, unable to go forward into her future. "There are things I don't remember," she says. I can't tell whether she means she makes it a practice not to think of them, or she cannot recall. To my relief, she has started to talk anyway, and she has the kind of finely articulated voice you occasionally come across here, which can turn this barking language into a song of aching beauty and finesse. Julia Berendt is the third of four girls. Her parents, born during the early years of the war, were both high school teachers in a town in Thüringen, the small state tucked in the southwestern corner of East Germany. Like many families, the Berendts were ambivalent about their country. "We weren't dissidents. We weren't in church groups or environmental groups or anything like that," Julia says. "We were an ordinary family. None of us had ever had a run-in with the state. Nevertheless, they lived with a distinct sense, from the minute we woke up, of what could be said outside the home, very little, and what could be discussed in it, most things." Julia's parents had different ways of managing their relationship with the authorities. Her mother, Irene, is a practical woman. She didn't expect a great deal from the state, and she didn't rock the boat to change it. As a girl, she had been a swimmer, a high jumper, and a trapeze artist. She told her daughters they could be anything they wanted to be. Julia's father, Dieter, is a sensitive man. He wanted to better what he saw as a flawed system, but one which, from its founding premise, was fairer than capitalism. Unlike his wife, he was a joiner. He joined the Free German Youth, the Freie Deutsche Jugend, or FDJ, the communist successor to the Hitler Youth, and later, as many teachers were encouraged to do, he even joined the party. For his pains, his country made him a pariah and his life a misery. "Every Wednesday before the party meetings, Dad would be in a foul mood," Julia says, "really grim." Dieter spoke up against things he disagreed with, such as recruiting eighth graders for the army, or teaching boring Russian socialist realist writers. He would come home hollow. "They dressed him down like a child there." In the GDR, people were required to acknowledge an assortment of fictions as fact. Some of these fictions were fundamental, such as the idea that human nature is a work in progress which can be improved upon, and that communism is the way to do it. Others were more specific, that East Germans were not the Germans responsible, even in part, for the Holocaust, that the GDR was a multi-party democracy, that socialism was peace-loving, that there were no former Nazis left in the country, and that under socialism, prostitution did not exist. Many people withdrew into what they called internal emigration. They sheltered their secret inner lives in an attempt to keep something of themselves from the authorities. After 1989, Dieter retired from teaching as soon as he could. He was depressed and required medication. "I think one could count him, too, as a victim of the regime," Julia says, "living for so long in a relation of unspoken hostility, but outward compliance to the state had broken him." Lately, a study has suggested that depressed people have a more accurate view of reality, though this accuracy is not worth a bean because it is depressing, and depressed people live shorter lives. Optimists and believers are happier and healthier in their unreal worlds. Julia and her family, like many others in the GDR, trod this line between seeing things for what they were in the GDR and ignoring those realities in order to stay sane. Ever since she can remember, Julia was interested in languages. Before she could read, she was fascinated by the Roman and Cyrillic letter systems she'd find around the house. At school, they were taught English very badly and Russian. Julia won first prize in the state Russian competition, a trip to Moscow. Curious about the world, she had pen pals in Algeria, the Soviet Union, and India. Her spare time was spent formulating letters in French, Russian, and English, and sending them off to the outside world. Julia wanted to be a translator and interpreter. I was growing up in the 1980s at the height of the Cold War. People really thought that the US and Russia might start a nuclear confrontation, and in the GDR we were on the front line. It was sort of naive, but I thought that by facilitating, even in this small way, communication among peoples, I could make a contribution. She shakes her head at herself, as if embarrassed by the extravagance of her hopes. But I don't see why a talented linguist who believed in her country should be embarrassed by this goal. Then again, I don't see in front of me a talented linguist who believed in her country. I see a woman who leaves her past in a box, but then comes to collect it, and whose part-time study and part-time rental agency work keep her only part attached to the world. Like her father, Julia believed in East Germany as an alternative to the West. I wanted to explain to people overseas about the GDR, that communism was not such a bad system. She didn't want to leave. We watched a lot of Western television, and I knew about unemployment, about homelessness, about hard drugs, and prostitution. Prostitution! I mean, how is it people think they can just buy a person? That was incredible to me. She doesn't seem bitter about her belief in the GDR now. She seems somehow nostalgic. She shivers. I go down to the cellar for more coal to feed the heater. When I come back into the kitchen, Julia has not moved. I'm relieved. I half expected to find one of the yellow sticky notes she sometimes leaves for me in her fine handwriting. Just remembered an appointment. Sorry, Jay. But she wants to keep talking. The edge of the linoleum table has come loose, and without thinking, she is stroking it flat. The memories do not come in the right order. As I listen, I think this is because she has not voiced them much before. But there may be another reason. Something her mind keeps returning to, which she veers away from telling. Chapter 10. The Italian Boyfriend. When she was 16, Julia worked in the holidays as an usher at the Leipzig Fair, the famous international trade fair for which, twice a year, East Germany opened itself up to the outside world. Exhibitors of machinery and books, photocopiers and kitchen appliances all visited, along with members of the Western press. They stayed in the Hotel Mirka, or were billeted to families who fought over them and the news from outside they might bring. Julia's job, along with that of other young people, selected as much for their loyalty as their language skills, was to direct visitors around the fair and the city. It was here that she met the Italian boyfriend. He asked her out almost immediately. "They all thought we were for sale." And she declined. "I wasn't." Eventually, as you do, she said yes, because he persisted, because it might be fun, because what harm could come of it? The Italian boyfriend was a man of 30 representing a northern Italian computer firm. He and Julia fell into the kind of unreal long-distance relationship in which longing, sustained by enough time apart, ripens of its own accord into love. He came to visit her twice a year, at Easter and Christmas, and they met for annual holidays in Hungary. Hungary was relatively free then. "For us, almost like the West," she says. The rest of the time they telephoned once a week and wrote frequent letters. He became her most intimate pen pal. "How long were you with him?" I ask. 2 years. "Oh, God, no, more like 2.5. Whenever he stayed with her, the surveillance was intense and overt. The couple could hardly leave the house without being stopped by the police and asked to account for themselves. Or the police would be waiting at a checkpoint on the outskirts of town. It didn't matter when we left the house or where we were going. There'd be someone there to stop us, she says. Sometimes they went through the car. If we said we were going to the pictures, they would disappear for long enough with my ID and his passport to make us miss the start. The Italian boyfriend was terrified at each search. He'd start to sweat, then he'd go all pale and literally shake with terror. Julia, on her home ground, teased him while they waited to get their papers back. "Look, it can't be that bad," she'd say. "What on earth do you imagine they're going to do with you? They're not going to kill you. This isn't Latin America, after all." "I lived with this sort of scrutiny as a fact," she says. "I didn't like it, but I thought, I live in a dictatorship, so that's just how it is. It was clear to me as a simple act of GDR logic. I am with a Western foreigner. Now I will be under observation." The Barents had no telephone, so Julia went to her grandmother's for the weekly call from the Italian boyfriend. His calls had to be booked through the authorities, and they both imagined it was possible they were being overheard. When I hung up, I'd say good night to him, then I'd say, "Night all," to the others listening in, she chuckles. I meant it as a joke. I didn't let myself really think about whether there was another person on the line. It was a condition of sanity both to accept GDR logic and to ignore it. If you took things as seriously as people in the West think we must have, we would have all killed ourselves. But I'm feeling agitated. The fluorescent light in the kitchen has started to vibrate. I mean, you'd go mad, she says, if you thought about it all the time. Julia topped her year in middle school and wanted to go to a senior high renowned for its language teaching. Instead, for reasons never made clear, the authorities sent her far away to a boarding school with no reputation at all. Her mother complained bitterly, but was told that nothing could be done. I don't know if it was because of the Italian boyfriend or the pen pals. Maybe they thought I had too much contact with the West and needed to be isolated. She has started to tap a pen on the table and not to look at me when she speaks. For a moment, the only sounds are the tapping pen, the vibrating light. She puts the pen down and smiles. She has found something lighter to tell. The school was strict, she says. There were things about it that were seriously traumatic, such as what we used to call TV torture. By the 1980s, most people in East Germany watched Western television, especially the news bulletins. No one watched the DDR news, despite the fact that it screened daily on both state-run television stations in a long and a short version. Julia smiles. At that school, every night without fail, we were sat down and made to watch Aktuelle Kamera in the long version. It was hell. The news program was so long because each time Erich Honecker was mentioned, he was announced with every single one of his titular functions. Julia sits up straight with her hands on the table and puts on a media voice. In the flickering light and with her flyaway hair, she is a newsreader from outer space, coming through static. Comrade Erich Honecker, Secretary General of the Socialist Unity Party of the German Democratic Republic, First Secretary of the Central Committee, Chairman of the State Council and of the National Defense Council, Leader of the Fighting Groups, blah-de-blah. We laugh and she pushes back onto two legs of the chair. She is a relaxed and confident mimic. And then the actual news item that came after all that would be null. She straightens up again. Today visited the steelworks such and such and spoke with the workers about the 1984 plan targets, which they have overachieved by so-and-so percent. Or, today opened the umpteenth apartment built in the new district of Marzahn. Or, congratulated the collective farm of Hicksville this morning for their extraordinary harvest results, an increase of so-and-so many-fold on previous years. We are laughing and laughing under the strobing light. And the thing about it was, she slapped the table with her fine white hand, it never told us anything that happened in the world. She shakes her head at the wordiness of no news. Worse, though, than no news was the anti-news. The students also had to watch Der Schwarze Kanal, the Black Channel, with Karl Edward von Schnitzler. I've heard about this man, the human antidote to the pernicious influence of Western television. At home, Julia says, everyone called him Karl Edward von Schni, because that was how long it took before one of us could jump up and change the channel. Von Schnitzler's job was to show extracts from Western television broadcast into the GDR, anything from news items to game shows to Dallas, and rip it to shreds. That man radiated so much nastiness, he simply wasn't credible. You'd come away feeling sullied, as if you'd spent half an hour atrociously bad-mouthing someone. Julia crossed her arms. I mean, you might have your doubts about the West, I sure did, but we also felt that our own country was feeding us lies, and that our futures depended on seeming to agree with it all. One day in 1984, the headmaster made an appointment to see Julia's parents at home. We should have guessed something at that point. That was unheard of. The three of them sat for 2 hours with coffee and cake, quite formal. He had come to convince Irene and Dieter to influence Julia to break it off with the Italian boyfriend. People assumed, if they didn't know Julia, that he was her ticket out. The state was using every avenue it could to stop that from happening. Julia's mother told the headmaster, "Look, the girl is 17. She's just about an adult. And if she's decided that this is the man for her life, so be it." But Irene also said, "To tell the truth, we're not all that happy about it either. He's a lot older than she is, and we don't want our daughter to leave, but we will not stand in her way." The headmaster didn't get very far. "He left dissatisfied," Julia says. "He was actually a nice man. It could be that he'd been warned about the consequences for me and was trying his best to help." In 1985, Julia matriculated with straight A's. She went to Leipzig to sit the entrance exam for the university's translating and interpreting course. She failed. The written language exam was ridiculously easy and short, but then there was the political exam. "What do you mean, political exam? You wanted to do language training?" The light tube on the ceiling is still spluttering and hissing, and I am bilious and annoyed. In this light, Julia's face is marble and her lips blue-rimmed. "Well, we were asked about our political knowledge. It was intended that we'd work at the highest levels of government, even internationally, so I think that's quite okay." "Of course it is. It's standard practice in the West, too. I am just oversensitized." I get up and find some tea-light candles in the cupboard so I can kill the fluorescent. I put the candles, thimbles of light, around the kitchen, on the sink, on the table, and on the windowsill behind Julia. "I don't know with any certainty that it was organized by them that I fail," Julia says. "There were an awful lot of applicants, and I have to admit that I did pretty crap in that exam." She says she didn't know things. Things that were not just faux pas, but really serious mistakes. She starts to laugh again. She couldn't name, for instance, the political parties in the GDR. There were political parties other than the ruling Socialist Unity Party, but they were parties in name only, and the names were remarkably similar to those of the political parties that existed for real in West Germany. The Christian Democrats, the Liberals, and so on. Julia says, "I was terrified of getting them wrong. If I put a name that was actually a Western party, I might well have failed." She gives the loose table lino a flick. Julia was being asked to repeat her knowledge of socialist catechism, her belief in things that were hard to remember because they were not real. After the results were announced, a former student of Dieter's took him aside. The man's wife and father-in-law were on the university board of examiners. Between you and me, he said to Dieter, there's no point Julia trying again next year. I would strongly suggest to you she do something else. Get a job.
Maybe, Julia says, like the headmaster, he was trying to do me a favour. Save me the trouble of reapplying.
She has started to look away from me, focusing her attention towards the dark corner of the room.
But the strange thing was, she says slowly, that afterwards I simply couldn't get a job. Any kind of job at all.
She fiddles with the scarf wrung around her neck.
That was when it got hard for me.
Julia thought she might work as a receptionist in a large hotel. That way she could practice her languages. She applied to Berlin, to Leipzig, to Dresden. She was a top student who spoke English, Russian, French, and a smattering of Hungarian. She always got an interview. She would present in her neat clothes and accept the compliments of management. The hoteliers were invariably excited and impressed. They would send her away for a routine medical, shake her hand warmly, and say they looked forward to seeing her soon. Sometimes a letter would come in the mail a week later.
We regret to inform you that the position has been filled. Thank you for your interest.
Other times she would call up herself to be told that she had just missed out. Sometimes she didn't hear at all. In the end, she stopped ringing to be told the same uncomfortable excuses. She tried to find a position as a waitress, also without success. Julia assumes now that every hotel and every restaurant was required to check the names of all new employees with the Stasi. Her options were running out. She decided to enroll in a night course for a certificate as a Stadtbilderklärerin, a town plan explainer.
A what?
I have never heard of this word. Julia says that it means a tour group leader, but that in the GDR the word leader, Führer, was forbidden after Hitler, der Führer. Because Führen can also mean to drive, this meant there were no train drivers. A Lokapitan or locomotive captain instead. And no driver's licenses, but a Fahrerlaubnis or permission to drive. Being a town plan explainer was an occasional way to earn pocket money. It was not a living. Julia went to the employment office, took a number, and stood in an interminable line. She was among people who might have had similar experiences, both explicable and not, to her own. She turned to the man behind her and asked, "So how long have you been unemployed?" Before he could answer, an official, a square-built woman in uniform, stepped out from behind a column.
"Miss, you are not unemployed," she barked.
"Of course I'm unemployed," Julia said. "Why else would I be here?"
"This is the employment office, not the unemployment office. You are not unemployed. You are seeking work."
Julia wasn't daunted.
"I'm seeking work," she said, "because I am unemployed."
The woman started to shout so loudly the people in the queue hunched their shoulders.
"I said you are not unemployed. You are seeking work."
And then, almost hysterically,
"There is no unemployment in the German Democratic Republic."
In my mind, I tote up further GDR fictions. That Der Führer was excised not only from their history, but also from their language. That the news was real on television. And, contrary to Julia's lived experience, that there was no unemployment. By no fault of her own, Julia Berendt had fallen into the gap between the GDR's fiction and its reality. She no longer conformed to the fiction. Loyal and talented as she was now being edged out of the reality. Julia could either think she had failed at everything she had tried, or that they were out to get her. Or she could try not to think at all.
"It is true to say that from then on I sort of withdrew from things."
She slept later and later each day.
"I think I was depressed," She enrolled in another night school course, this time in Spanish, but it seemed to her more and more like learning secret codes used outside your cave, spoken in places you would never see. After class, she went, nearly every night, to the local nightclub. My parents just sort of let me go. There wasn't much else they could do. I think they felt sorry for me. It was at this time her younger sister Catherine noticed it. The car was white. She watched it 3 days in a row outside the house before she said anything. Julia hadn't seen it. As I said, she looks at me, I knew that car was there for me. She knew, too, that getting on with her life would mean leaving it behind. She was going to have to marry the Italian boyfriend and get out. The idea frightened her. That was part of my attraction for him, that I would be utterly dependent on him, in his home and his country and his language, at his mercy. She went to meet him for a holiday in Hungary. At the airport, she was taken aside and her luggage searched. They unscrewed the hairdryer and emptied her boxes of tampons over the examination bench. In Hungary, she told him it was over. He was so controlling, so jealous. Now Julia had withdrawn from him, withdrawn into her home, and withdrawn from hope. This was more than internal emigration. It was exile. Chapter 11. Major N. Then a card came in the letterbox. It seemed normal enough. A standard printed card, as if I had to report to the police to have my ID renewed. It had spaces in it for them to handwrite my name and the date and time of the appointment. She is not looking at me. She's hardly talking to me. Her eyes move around the room, although there's not much to see. Behind me, the hot water cistern over the sink with its little blue flame, to my left, the door to the hall. Candlelight catches her face, etches cheekbone and chin. She is remembering as I watch, summoning presences more real than mine. There are some things... She stops. I don't think I'll be able to remember this. I haven't remembered this. I stick to small facts. Did you know what the card was about? I thought I had overstayed my visa in Hungary. Usually they would just re-stamp your ID at the border and let you back in. I started preparing excuses in my mind. At the same time I said to myself, look, it can't be that bad. What can they do to me? I mean, I wasn't afraid they'd collect me in the night and lock me up and torture me. Julia analyzed the situation from every angle. In its later stages, the regime stopped, for the most part, direct action, arrest, incarceration, torture, against its people. It opted instead for other ways of silencing them, methods that amnesty would find harder to chronicle. The typical thing that could happen to you in my day in the GDR, that your career was broken before it was begun, that had already happened to me. And now that I didn't even have the Italian boyfriend anymore, what else could they want? The police station had a vast waiting hall. People stood silently in two long queues curled around the room, each one joined to a counter. The lines hardly moved. I took a number, but then I realized I didn't know which queue was the right one, she says. So I went up to the policewoman who was overseeing things. She looked at my card and said straight away, Ah, Miss Berendt, you don't need to queue at all. You are to go directly to room 118. Julia laughs at herself. I was pleased at first. I thought I had got out of standing in line. Then she noticed that all the people in the queues were going into one of two rooms behind the counters, but neither of those was room 118. I had to go by myself up several flights of stairs and down a long corridor, left around a corner and then left again. There were no people around. I saw no one enter or leave any of the rooms I passed. Room 118 was way over on the other side of the building. She knocked.
Come in.
There was a man alone behind a desk. The first thing she noticed was that he wore a western suit and a good tie. He stood up straight away, a small nod, his feet clicking together.
Miss Berendt, I am N, Major,
he smiled. He smiled and extended his hand. And then, clear as a bell,
Ministry of State Security.
She felt fear, she says, like a worm in my belly. The man was not yet 40, with a wide face and receding hair. He wore small, round eyeglasses. He had a glowing suntan. He was friendly. In fact, for GDR standards, exaggeratedly polite.
Please, he said, do sit down.
They sat. She thought it might still, perhaps, be about the overstayed visa. But N began.
Such an attractive, intelligent young woman as yourself, Miss Berendt. Perhaps you could explain to me why it is,
he smiled,
that you are not working.
This was it. Up until this moment, it could all have been a product of her imagination. The boarding school, the headmaster's visit, the constant street searches, the failed exam, the friend's warning, the cruising larder, the extraordinary unemployment. She was in shock. She spoke slowly.
You must know why I have no job, she said.
His voice was soft. He did not stop smiling.
How would I know that, Miss Berendt?
Her mind flew. She could see where this was going. She was going to be kicked out of the country. I thought it was my last chance to stay home, she says. So she told him straight out,
Look, please, I don't want to go to the West, but I think you people are forcing me out.
She realized she was imploring him.
I must work somewhere. I am, after all, unemployed.
But Miss Berendt, he said, how can that be?
He laced his fingers together on the desk.
There is no unemployment in the German Democratic Republic.
She could not answer. He reached across his desk to a pile of papers and pulled them to him.
First, I have some questions, he said, about these letters.
Julia looked at his hand and saw, under it, her own handwriting. She was confused. She looked closer. They were copies of her letters to the Italian boyfriend. Julia had imagined all along that her mail might be being read. Sometimes letters she received from overseas had been brutally torn and taped back together with a sticker, damaged in transit. It was ridiculous, really, she says, but like all the other things, she had never thought about it for long. Major N laid the first letter flat on the desk and smoothed it out with both hands. He cleared his throat. To Julia's horror, he started to read it aloud. I think of the shame I would feel sitting opposite Major So-and-so in his office with these intimate things in his fingers. Shame at hearing your words turn into the universal banalities of love in his mouth. Julia and her boyfriend wrote to one another in English. Major N had underlined in each letter the words he had not been able to find in his German-English dictionary.
He sat there and he...
Julia stops and takes a sip of tea. It must be cold by now. It goes down the wrong way. She coughs and coughs, but puts her hand out to stop me helping.
And he asked me, she says in a choked voice, what they meant.
The hairs on my forearm stand up. I've stopped looking at Julia now because in this dimness she ceased addressing her words to me some time ago. I am humbled for reasons I cannot at this moment unravel. I am outraged for her and vaguely guilty about my relative luck in life. Major N took his time perfecting his translation.
The words that were not in the dictionary were, mostly, the words of their private lover's language. He asked her, "What is the meaning of this?" And again, "Would you mind, please, explaining this term?" One long forefinger on her handwriting or her lover's. "What about this?" he asked, touching the word Kokoritsa in a letter from her boyfriend.
Kokoritsa, Julia told him, is the Hungarian word for corn.
What does this mean, then, Miss Berendt, when your friend writes, "I want my little Kokoritsa"? She had to explain. On their holidays, her hair had lightened to the color of corn. Kokoritsa was his pet name for her.
"Thank you, Miss Berendt."
Then, in his Western suit, with his foreign manners and his exaggerated courtesy, Major N proceeded through her relationship, one letter at a time.
"It took quite a while," Julia says in a faraway voice.
Her eyes are fixed in the middle distance. Major N was thorough. There was a pile of her letters to the Italian. There was a pile of his letters back to her. This man knew everything. He could see when she had had doubts. He could see by what sweet talking she had let herself be placated. He could see the Italian boyfriend's longing laid bare, and his invention, for his own pleasure, of his faraway girl. N insinuated he knew, as Julia surely also realized, that the Italian had an image of her that didn't quite hit the mark. He flattered her.
"You are more complex, I think, Miss Berendt, and much more intelligent than he gives you credit for."
When he was done reading, pointing, probing, he straightened the two piles of letters and put them back to the side of the desk.
"Let us discuss your friend for a moment now," he said, "shall we?"
He started to tell Julia about her boyfriend.
"They weren't particularly spectacular things," she says, "but they were things I couldn't go to Italy and see for myself."
Julia assumes that the Stasi had people in Italy.
"He was even sort of witty about it, drawing me in, as if we could both have a chuckle about aspects of my boyfriend's life, as if we were both on the same side, and it was my friend, not I, who was the object of observation."
"As we know," N said, "our friend is in the computer business."
Julia nodded.
"I never understood much about the sort of business he was in," she says, "and with my East German mindset, not at all. He had told me it was a trade in computer components."
N specified it for her.
"He is a sales manager for the regional branch of the firm."
Then he described the boyfriend's family house in Umbria. He told her the make of car he drove. When he saw that this meant nothing to Julia, he interpreted it for her. In N's estimation, it was a middle-class sort of car.
"So there's no thinking he's rich or anything."
Julia wondered where this was going. He opened his desk drawer and brought out a thick manila folder, which he put, closed, on the desk.
"Now, Miss Berendt," he said,
"we come to you."
He evaluated her life in progress.
"He knew everything about me," she says. "He knew all the subjects I'd taken and how I did in them. He knew all about each of my sisters, my parents. He knew my youngest sister wanted to study piano at the conservatory."
Major N felt sufficiently informed to make some psychological assessments. He told her that there were clearly issues her father did not understand, that Dieter was problematic. Irene, by contrast, was much more loyal to the state.
"It is clear to us on the evidence, Miss Berendt, that you take after your mother," he said, "which, if I may be so bold as to say so, is a good thing."
"He was showing me that he had me in the palm of his hand," she says.
Julia draws her knees up to her chest and places her heels on the seat. She stretches her jumper over the knees, making herself into a small black ball.
"The only thing," she says, It's ironic, but the only thing that they seemed not to know was that I'd broken up with my boyfriend. Since their split in Hungary, the Italian boyfriend had written several imploring letters. Julia had replied to the first one, but then stopped writing. "Or at least the Major acted as if he didn't know that we'd broken up," she says. "I thought it was strange that he didn't know. Maybe he'd been on holidays and had missed the last couple of letters. Or I think he might have known and thought his prospects with her then were better." N put the manila folder to one side next to the love letters. He joined the tips of his fingers together and leant forward.
"As I'm sure you will have picked up, we are interested in your friend."
And then it came.
"We would propose," he said, "if you would assist us, that we meet every now and again for a chat."
Julia says, "I thought it was absurd. I thought, what on earth could interest them in him?" She could not imagine that the Italian boyfriend was in any way a bigwig. He did not have any high-up connections he ever mentioned, or any special expertise or training at all. It did not occur to her until she got home that it could have been her they wanted. There was no question for Julia. She would not inform on him, or at all. "I am terribly sorry," she told Major N, "but I can't help you because we split up on this last trip to Hungary. I want nothing more to do with him. He wanted to own me. I knew if I stayed with him, I would not be able to determine my own life." She added, "I never want to see him again, even as a friend." N smiled.
"If," he said, "after giving the matter some further thought, you reach a different decision, you should not hesitate to call at any time."
He gave her his card with his phone number on it.
"Oh, and Miss Berendt," he said, "one more thing. You must not discuss our little talk with anyone. Not your parents, not your sisters, not your closest friends. If you do, we will know about it. This afternoon has not occurred. You have never been to room 118. If you see me on the street, you are not to acknowledge me. You must walk on past. All this for obvious reasons, as I'm sure you will have understood long ago."
She nodded. And that was it. He had shown her that with one phone call to him, she could be in or she could be out. She could be with them or she could be gone. And then he let me leave. The street was another world, the daylight bright and unnatural. Julia watched a class of small children being herded along the pavement. She felt sundered, suddenly and irrevocably, from life. "It was as though all at once I was on the other side," she says, "separate from everybody." Julia seems to have run out of words, so I pick up the plates and place them behind me in the sink. I look in the fridge for something else to eat, as if it might yield possibilities missed at first glance. There's only a saggy old condom of liverwurst and an apple. I throw out the liverwurst and cut up the apple. Whilst I have my back to her, she starts to speak again. To listen to her is to witness the process, almost mechanical, of pulling things up from the past. Her voice is slow. "I think I totally repressed that entire episode," she says. "Maybe what came later, the whole 1989 story, was so severe that other things just fell away. Otherwise, I can't explain it." I don't know what she means by the whole 1989 story. I say I think it is extreme, what happened to her. "Yes, it is," she says. "When you become conscious of it. But the strange thing is, it's only now, in this room, that I feel the shudder run down my spine. At the time, I criticized other things, not being allowed to study or have a career. But looking back on it, it's the total surveillance that damaged me the worst. I know how far people will transgress over your boundaries until you have no private sphere left at all. And I think that is a terrible knowledge to have. She flicks her hair as if to get rid of something. At this distance, I understand for the first time how bad it was what he did in that room. She takes a piece of apple and seesaws its fleshy arc between two fingers on the table. The empty fridge shudders and stops. The kitchen is a deeper quiet. "People talk about the unconscious," she says, "and it becomes clear to me as I am telling you this, the effect this knowledge has had on my life." She takes a small bite of apple. "I think I'm definitely psychologically damaged." She laughs, but she means it. "That's probably why I react so extremely to approaches from men and so on. I experience them as another possible invasion of my intimate sphere." She watches my face. "I think it's worse if you repress it. To dig it up, or to leave it lie in the ground." When she left room 118, Julia was all right until she got home. Then her legs wouldn't hold her weight. She made it to the bathroom and vomited. When she came out, she noticed her voice trembled, and she couldn't set it straight. She told her parents and her sisters everything. That evening, the family sat down to decide what to do. "My mother is a very pragmatic person," Julia says. Irene said, "Right, you ended it with the Italian. I didn't want to influence you, but I'm glad you didn't marry him. Now, though, you have to think very coolly about what you do next." Julia couldn't quite believe that this was happening, that they were sitting in the living room at home, talking about how she might live out the rest of her life. She was 20 years old. "We'd always discussed me going to live with the Italian boyfriend, as if it were an option. But that was more like a teenage adventure fantasy, thinking, I'm free to do that and no one can stop me. Suddenly, it was reality. I have to leave here forever. I have to leave my family. I will not see my sisters again, and I have to go to the West, which, as I said, I had never wanted to do." Julia has started to speak into the jumper wrapped over her knee. "And I think, too, I was disappointed in the state. I realized for the first time that it wasn't really the good father state you have in the back of your mind. I saw it can be so dangerous, so very dangerous, without me having done anything at all." She would not become an informer. That left only one real option. "You'll have to find someone else to marry so you can get out," Irene said. "That's the only way." Then she voiced all of their doubts. "But do you really want to marry an old person?" she said. Dieter sat hunched in rage and sadness at the end of the table. No one spoke. "That's when I thought of it," Julia says. "I thought, if there's no way around it, we just have to crash through somehow." There was apparently this method called a Staatsratsbeschwerde for people to write directly to Erich Honecker if they needed something they couldn't get, or to make a complaint. She shakes her head, as if the citizen really did have a voice and rights. People would write saying they wanted to buy tiles for their bathroom or machine parts for their tractor, and none had been available since August or whatever. Ordinary people would sometimes say, "Well, why don't you stop complaining and just write to Erich?" So I thought to myself, why don't we? I mean, if we examined it, what had happened was just not right. I see the mimic in her again. "I don't even have this boyfriend anymore. I want to study and I want to stay in the GDR, and why not? We can just write to Erich and complain." She looks up at the ceiling. There was a certain naivety in this that I see today. Back then, we thought that the party and the state were one thing, and the Stasi another. She shakes her head and unravels herself from her jumper, placing both feet on the ground. She opens her hands wide. I thought, well, what can they do to me? Major N's card lay on the table between them all. You have the phone number, Irene said. Call him up tomorrow and tell him that you and your parents are going to write to Honecker and make a complaint. I will never forget that night, Julia says. I said to my parents, right then, that's what we'll do, and I went to bed. I had nightmares like I have never had before or since. Julia dreamt she was being pursued in a place where everything was familiar to her. The kitchen countertop, the view from her bedroom, the faces in a shop, the back of her sister's head. But no one recognized her, and she was not at home. Her father started to die, wilting like a plant and calling for her, but he couldn't hear her responses, couldn't see where she was. When she woke, she didn't know if she'd dreamt of where she was or wherever it was she was going. The night was terrible, terrible. I don't remember if I cried. I don't think I did. I just sweated and sweated till the bed was wet. I woke up many times. It was truly terrifying what I lived through. She runs a hand through her hair. It was the loss of everything until I had disappeared too. The next morning after everyone left, Julia picked up the card and took it to her grandmother's to make the call. She was alone in the house. She could smell disinfectant and boiled potatoes. She looked at the numbers in black on the card. They moved. She saw her hand was shaking and put the card down on the bench. In that moment, she could no longer string together the reasons why she was making this call, how it came to this. She was just here, now, with this card and this name and the numbers that would make him speak to her again. She put her fingers in the loops to dial. N picked up straight away. When he realized what she was saying, "You told others what we said? You are going to write what?" He was furious and demanded that Julia meet with him alone. She was to come to a covert apartment in town. "It was over, of all things, the travel agency," she says. She put her lips together with a grim smile. Of course I'd gazed in that window many times. I knew exactly where it was. N told her there would be serious repercussions for her and possibly for her family from this breach of her undertaking of silence. He reminded her that her younger sister Catherine, was it not correct, dreamed of studying piano at the conservatory. He said he would contact his superior, the regional head, and see what action was to be taken from here. The family waited a week before a card came in the letterbox. They were to be visited at home. Two of them came, N and his boss. But it was not at all what we anticipated, Julia says. N looked completely different to me. He was sweating and uncomfortable. His boss didn't look much better. We didn't know what was going on. Dieter told them there was no reason. What reason could there be for all the things that had happened to their daughter? They had always been good citizens. Irene told them flatly that they were going to write to Honecker. The men held their hands up. There was no need to overreact here. Surely, they said, things had not gone so far that they couldn't be fixed locally. There was no need to get Berlin involved. This was a situation, they looked at Dieter and Irene, where the imagination of a young person, a good quality, of course, might have come into play. Dieter and Irene and the girls were silent. Then the men asked to be given some time. We couldn't figure it out at first, Julia says, but when they left, we knew we'd won. We had never really known where the battle was, she smiles, but we knew we'd won. Julia doesn't know why the Stasi was afraid of them complaining to Honecker. Possibly because both her parents were teachers and outwardly conformist, or because the Stasi had no legal basis for what it had done to her.
Who knows? It is one of the very rare occasions when the bluff was called and someone won against the firm.
The amazing thing was, Julia says, the next week I was rung up about a job.
She was taken on as a receptionist in a hotel. It looked like she would work there for her lifetime. But then came 1989.
That's a whole other story.
She picks up her box of love letters.
It's late. I should go, she says. I thought I'd come and get these.
She pats the box and have a look at them. I'm seeing a psychotherapist and we've got up to my relationships with men. I'm trying to remember them. They seem like another life. She smiles and the light catches her teeth.
These letters from the Italian boyfriend will be an aide memoir to all that, she says.
I look at the box in her arms and know that you cannot destroy your past, nor what it does to you. It's not ever really over.
I see her out.
In the hall, she clicks the bike pump onto the crossbar of her beat-up bicycle, and I open the door. As she goes down the stairs, I feel there is something missing here. She does not seem like a girl who called their bluff, worked in a hotel for 2 years and was then liberated into her future by the 1989 revolution. No one can tote up life's events and calculate the damages. A table of maims for the soul. But this is not the full sum of things, I think, as Julia rides back to her barricaded tower, full of things she can't leave, but can't look at either.
Chapter 12. The Lipsy.
You pig dogs think we all here forgotten what you Nazis done and come in my home on my TV with you music and you news, you fuck-ups better write me and...
There's a knock on my office door. It's Uwe.
How about a lift home? He says.
That would be great. From some stupid impulse, I move to hide the letter in front of me, as if to spare him insult. I hold his gaze and pull it towards me across the desk. The printing is as large and uneven as a ransom note, so it catches his eye.
What's that one? He asks.
It's, actually, a piece of hate mail, I say.
Oh,
he says.
Yes.
He knows immediately what that means. That the hate is not directed at a particular presenter or the station itself, but at the whole nation.
We usually respond to those in a moderate tone, he says, and say that the National Socialist dictatorship was a terrible thing that happened to us, that it caused untold pain and suffering and so on, and that whatever attempts there have been to make reparations, amends can never truly be made, etc., etc.
Yes, I say, but what does he mean, that happened to us? The Germans were wild about Hitler. It is true that after he was elected, he changed the structures of power into a dictatorship, but it is also true that when the war was over, the people might well have voted him in again. Everyone always is claiming innocence here.
Well then,
he says. His eyes are red-rimmed. He doesn't give himself much rest.
Do you want a lift?
Yes, thanks. Great. I am rarely in a car in Berlin. The train network under the streets is so dense I can go anywhere on it, popping out of the earth in one place or another. It is a skein of arteries pumping people around the city. The surface is another world. The streets are cobbled. Uwe drives fast. He wears leather gloves with press studs on the wrists. His car is a new silver VW Golf, shiny and smelling of pineapple deodorizer.
"Do you like Elton John?" he says.
Before I can answer, he turns on the tape deck full blast. He lights a cigarette from the dash lighter. He starts nodding his head and tapping the beat with a leather hand on the leather-covered steering wheel. He's screaming down the streets, the tires noisy over the cobbles. I hold onto the door handle with one hand and my little pack on my lap with the other. I wonder whether the pack might have some airbag effect. He's humming and smoking and tapping and ashing out the window in a frenetic demonstration of how laid back he is. He shouts something through the music and smoke and din,
All I catch is that he's taking drum lessons to get, I watch his mouth, better rhythm. That's where I'm off to now, he yells. My teacher lives in Mitte, like you. Speaking of which, did you follow up any of those Aussie stories you were talking about?
He doesn't ask this as if I need to redeem myself from my outburst with Scheller. He seems genuinely curious, and he turns the music down. Yes, I did, I say. I've been having adventures in Stasiland. He laughs, so I go on. I've been in a place where what was said was not real, and what was real was not allowed, where people disappeared behind doors and were never heard from again, or were smuggled into other realms.
Really? How did you find these people?
They're all around, Asue. This was the East, after all, and I've gone looking. I advertised for Stasi men.
You did what?
He looks at me, and I wish he'd look back at the road. I put an ad in the paper, Uwe. It was no big deal. And other people I've just stumbled across. My landlady, for instance, I say. And I tell him briefly about Julia's expulsion from life until the Stasi offered to redeem her if she would inform for them. And this was as late as the 1980s, I finish.
No shit, Uwe says.
And I can see that Julia's story is as strange and awful for him as it is for me. He slows to a stop. We have reached my place intact. He turns to me.
Two things, he says, in his serious journalist's voice. There's a man around who, as a young Stasi officer, drew the line along the street where the wall would be built, and he's prepared to talk about the whole thing. His name is Hagen Koch. We had him on a program once about Checkpoint Charlie, and what you said about turning one world into another made me think of someone else. There is a fellow called Karl Edward von Schnitzler. He was the chief propagandist for the regime. He might be interesting for you, too.
Julia mentioned von Schnitzler. He's still alive, then?
Yep, and fierce, from what I hear.
How can I find them?
I'll see whether we've got any contact details at work.
Uwe leans across me to open my door, which is sort of gentlemanly but also unnecessary. He takes the opportunity to look up and check out my building. Thanks for the lift, I say, and thanks for the tips. He smells of smoke and fake pineapple, like a seedy Hawaiian.
No problem.
He's still leaning across me, so I follow his gaze. In the bare tree outside my living room, two white things float in the branches. One is a plastic bag, and the other, as we both stare up at it, reveals itself to be a pair of men's underpants. I shrug. I can tell Uwe would never live in a place like this. He leans back into his seat.
Good luck in Stasiland, he says. Take care there.
A few days later, Uwe does find me a number for von Schnitzler, but it's wrong.
Lady,
the man who answers tells me,
people like that don't want to be found.
Herr von Schnitzler is unlisted. I decide to call Herr Vins to see if he can help. Herr Vins is chuffed to think I need him and says he'll see what he can do. In the meantime, I decide to watch some of von Schnitzler's programs, The Black Channel. The Black Channel was broadcast in the East from 1960. It was intended as a countermeasure to the Western program, Das Rote Optik, The Red View, a critique of socialism being broadcast into the East from West Germany. On Monday nights, Deutscher Fernsehfunk, then the single East German television station, screened beloved old movies from the heyday of the pre-war studios, and the party decided that these, as well as the Western programs, required commentary. Karl Edward von Schnitzler was given the job. For a long time, workers in the power stations were on alert every Monday night. First, everyone tuned in at once to the movie, so they went into overdrive. Then, when the Black Channel came on, the workers had to struggle to stop the power supply from collapsing under a back surge as everyone simultaneously switched off their sets. Karl Edward von Schnitzler became a one-man institution, and the most hated face of the regime. at the end of 1989, when the demonstrators called out, "We are the people!" and "Free elections!" They also shouted, "Say sorry, Schnitzler!" and "Schnitzler to the Muppet Show!" That was exactly what he was. A grumpy old puppet throwing scorn on proceedings from on high. The East German television station was at Adlershof, an eastern suburb of Berlin. The complex is now being touted as a hot new multimedia center, but remains a cluster of cold, grey buildings set in an expanse of gravel like an industrial park. One of them houses the archive of programs broadcast in the GDR. This place isn't really open to the public, and Uwe has made some calls to get me in. I enter what seems to be a back door and then walk along a grimy, glass-sided gangway linking this building to the next. There are no people around. I come to double doors with an old security intercom. I ring in and they open for me. Ahead, there's a counter. In either direction, right and left, a long linoleum corridor stretches out, strewn with ancient editing equipment and piles of film reels. Behind the counter, I find the first signs of life. Two men in what look like matching brown cardigans are drinking coffee. They take a look at me and turn back immediately to one another. "Good morning," I say.
"Have you come for a parcel?"
Cardigan One asks, staring straight at Cardigan Two. "No," I say. "I've come to look at some tapes."
"We wouldn't know anything about that,"
Cardigan One says. He still doesn't look at me. There's a silence. "Is Frau Andersen about?" I ask.
"She'd have to see Frau Andersen about that, wouldn't she?"
One says to his silent companion. Two takes a sip. One reads this as agreement.
"Yes," one repeats. "She'd have to see Frau Andersen about that."
I glance up and down the empty corridor.
"It's getting on for time," he adds. "We leave here at 4:25, you know."
"Right," I say. Cardigan Two speaks.
"We're on a break,"
he says to One.
"Right,"
I say again. There's another silence. What is this, Beckett? I remember what the German absurdist poet Kurt Tucholsky said about his countrymen and counters. They all grovel in front of them and aspire to sit behind them. I am tossing up whether to grovel like a native or to make a scene foreign style when I am saved by footsteps coming along the corridor. Frau Andersen.
"There you are, then,"
Cardigan One says to Cardigan Two, as if this whole little episode had been a private bet between them.
"Frau Andersen."
Frau Andersen is a woman in her mid-50s. It is hard to tell what she really looks like because she is wearing makeup to disguise. Perhaps she used to be on the stage or in television. She has shiny skin the consistency of cheesecake and lips painted on in a shape that departs boldly and theatrically from nature.
"Ah, Herr von Schnitzler,"
she says as she leads me down the corridor.
"He was a one. You've got to give it to him. At least he has stuck with what he said back then. Not a damn turncoat like the rest of them these days."
Her bitterness and nostalgia shock me. It is part of the nostalgia for the East, Ost, which has given rise to a new sticklebrick word, ostalgie. Clearly only those demonstrably loyal to the state worked here, and Frau Andersen is still one of them. The corridor is fluorescent lit, without a chink of natural light. The linoleum is beige, and either mottled or marbled. The walls are a peeling, bilious yellow. There's a stale smell. It is like being inside some old beast. We walk the length of the corridor, and I count, from habit or obsession or just not wanting to get lost, 15 steel doors on each side before we get to the last one. Frau Andersen opens it and turns to me.
"I leave at 4:25, she says. "Do you think you'll be done by then?"
"I hope so," I say,
"It would be terrible," she jokes, "to leave you locked up here overnight."
It sure would. This place seems to have been designed on the same one-size-fits-all architectural principle as everything else. The Runde Ecke in Leipzig and Stasi HQ at Normannenstrasse, the same as prisons and hospitals and schools and administrative buildings all over this country, and probably the same as inside the Brown Palace der Republik, only it's behind bars and I can't get in. From here to Vladivostok, this was communism's gift to the built environment. Linoleum and grey cement. Asbestos and prefabricated concrete and always long, long corridors with all-purpose rooms. Behind these doors, anything could be happening. Interrogations, imprisonment, examinations, education, administration, hiding out from nuclear catastrophe or, in this case, propaganda. Inside, the room has the proportions of a prison cell, but is decorated like a trailer home from the 1960s.